This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Gen Con!
70s fantasy film essentials.
25 years of the Ennies with Stacey Muth.
And redrawing a redrawn border.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near-catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin! The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now! The checklist full of things to pack, the suitcase that we're now unpacking, let us know that we're once more about to issue a travel advisory. And this time around, things are a little different here on the podcast because it's post-Gen Con, but only one of us went to Gen Con. That one of us was not me. This time, Pelgrane opted to have a skeleton crew, not a skeletonized crew. That would be for Gamehole. So it was just our U.S. pals running the booth, and among our U.S. pals, for the purposes of this podcast, the paragon of our U.S. pals, Ken was there and I wasn't. So Ken, was it a weird Gen Con in any other way than that?
Well, in, you know, obviously being the only inflatable arm wave guy at the car lot is a big responsibility, and that changed a little of the vibe. I was pinned to the booth a little more than I normally am, but other than that, it was Gen Con. There was, you know, let's say I normally say 500 of my closest friends. There was 490 of my closest friends. Everyone jammed up once more. The ritual round progressed from Diana Jones party all the way through someone else doing teardown. So it was a Gen Con. Ken and Robin live podcast, as I believe many listeners already know, but if you don't, I'll tell you now, had beloved guest star and friend of the program, Darcy Ross, filling in for Robin. It also opened with a dance party as I tested the thoroughly untested soundbar, but everything worked out great. So yeah, it was Gen Con. I was just a little more in one place. I didn't get to sort of wander the whole hall like I normally try to. My buddy Greg came by and I saw, you know, some of the far reaches of the show, including noting that there were two separate games about the historical Black Death of the 1340s. One was from Two Little Mice, was called Memento Mori, was up for a any award and looked gorgeous. It had sort of early modern anatomy style art. And the conceit there is that because you are dying of the plague, your body is so dead that you can exert power and energy across the veil separating us from the land of the dead. And so you can do magic. And the trouble is that every time you do that, more of you dies. So you like might, your name might die. Your ability to, you know, speak Latin might die. Your spleen might die as pieces of your actual body get chopped off. So it's a literal death spiral of a game. It looked amazing. And then right around the corner from that was a different game called Plagia 1348, where the Black Death has caused many of the dead to be rise again as revenants. And you hunt them down as members of the secret church Ordo Mortis. So it's a survival horror game in the best imaginable landscape for that. And it looked really good. They had medieval woodcut style art. It was very strong. And seeing both of them there in close proximity was sort of the highlight of my trip out of the booth. And my friend Greg said, I wonder what recently happened to make game designers think, let's set a game in the Black Death. And neither of us could think of anything, so we just moved on. But it was...
Well, speaking of which,
right.
Last year's review show, one of the big takeaways was that was the year where everybody got, like a lot of people got COVID.
Yeah.
You and I were exposed to it, didn't get it. About half of our people at the booth did get it. And big chunks of, you know, just booth after booth by the last day.
Yeah, it was a strong year for the summer COVID wave last year.
Right. So did COVID have another supplement to release this year?
COVID just had a PDF. You could go to their website and download it. We did hear of a couple of cases, but it was not the sort of dead man walking field on Sunday that it was last year. And the whole Pelgrane booth was perky and sunny and uninfected at the beginning and at the end of the show. It was very strong epidemiological performance for us. So whether or not our various beloved and would never not see them San Diego Comic-Con people simply licked different actors this time than last time, or whether it was genuinely a weak wave, as some of the indicators were indicating, we'll take it. A no-COVID Gen Con is a Gen Con where everyone can run around and have more fun. And that is what many of us did.
Everyone would love to have that in the past. Speaking of other current events, you were pinned to the booth during the day. So unless people came around to talk shop at you, I imagine you heard less scuttlebutt than other years. But then there are the evening hours in which scuttlebutt might be gathered. Was the word tariff mentioned often, or were people not worried about that so much?
Well, as always, the secret is to not be the latest bad news. The word diamond was mentioned way more often than the word tariff, at least in my corner of Scuttlebutt City. I think that a lot of the people who evoked tariffs were either also caught in the diamond bankruptcy, or by now the sort of conventional wisdom is this was either the last thing that pushed an unsteady house of bricks over, or this was their excuse for why they were going to go out of business this year anyway.
Right. And maybe give people a bit more context on diamond if they're not deep in the rabbit hole.
Yeah. Diamond Distributors was the, well, let's say allegedly corrupt main distributor for the comic book industry. They merged with bought Alliance, which was by that time the last big distributor standing in the tabletop game industry, and had a floor agreement in that they held the inventory for a lot of tabletop game companies, especially RPG companies, because the assumption was that if Alliance could look at their own warehouse, they would stop saying things were out of stock. This, of course, turned out to be wrong, but
since saying it was out of stock was an excuse in the first place,
was easier. And since they never bought a warehouse inventory system that would even let them know what they had in their own warehouse. So Alliance outfoxed everyone by being even worse at their job than I thought they were. So when they merged with Diamond, Diamond carried along and continued to run things as badly as a monopoly always runs things. And then Marvel and DC both noticed they were getting terrible service and pulled out of Diamond, which began a death spiral for Diamond. They went bankrupt. They declared bankruptcy, I guess, towards the end of last year. And according to a strange provision of bankruptcy law. It is as though bankruptcy laws are written by banks, Robin. You'll never believe this. A warehouse that goes bankrupt has to send, I assume, a tiny little pink index card on slippy paper out to say, we're going bankrupt, come get your stuff. And if you don't write them immediately and say, you don't have our stuff, we're sending a truck, then they get to sell it to pay off their main creditors, who are, of course, the banks holding their note. So,
right. And by they, it's some other entity and some other person who's come in to maximize the amount of money that goes to the secured creditors.
This is the old diamond that is doing this particular scam, because this is old diamond that declared the bankruptcy in the first place. The new owners.
So they're not in full receivership. It's just a reorganization.
No, it's a full receivership. I mean, they are gone, but this is the thing that happens when you declare bankruptcy. You're not stricken from the face of the earth. There are still assets and there are still absolutely debts. Right. And so sorting out the few assets and the massive debts is the job of a bankruptcy court. And that is what is going on as the new corporate owners of Diamond wait to assume the shattered husk of that company and see if a distribution company can be built out of it. Once all the debts are wiped clear, which I guess is the point of buying a bankrupt company.
Right. So anyway, a bunch of people got stuck with, they now have their inventory.
Right.
They can't recover. And even worse, it's being sold off at, or will be sold off at bargain rates, flooding the market.
Yeah.
So that not only are you not getting paid for your thing, but you're now in competition with your old inventory that you can't recover.
Right. And the biggest of those companies so mishandled is Paizo. Our best friends of those companies is Green Ronin. But there's a lot of companies that are in that fix, including a lot of board game companies. And board game companies, like We Need to Tell Anyone, don't need the extra hit that this is going to cause. And role-playing companies, of course, live and die by their inventory. So it's not a good... it's not a good look for anyone. Paizo, I believe, is leading a lawsuit to try and get the things back. But as I said, banks write bankruptcy court law. So good luck, Paizo and Green Ronin and all of our other buddies with stock on the floor of some warehouse in Tennessee somewhere. Assuming that it hasn't already been sold off to whoever it is takes bulk copies of Starfinder. I don't even know who that would be, but it's not a good situation for anybody. And that was what was sort of occupying the mind of anyone either involved in it directly or whose friends, business partners, et cetera, were involved in it, which, as I say, is pretty much the whole tabletop industry at one level or another.
Now, you presented at the Annies.
I did.
And so were there any broad trends or events that occurred in reference to that or the various other award shows that happen at Gen Con?
I did not pay as much attention as I often do to the Indie Game Design Awards. I'm sure that they went to worthy and noble designers, but the Annies were a big year for Exalted Funeral Press. They had their Land of Eem, which is sort of a kid-friendly Adventure Times type fantasy universe, and it did very well, and they had some other stuff from them that got awards and got nominations. It was a good year for Exalted Funeral. Free League got the fan favorite publisher and won product of the year with their Moria book by our beloved friend, Gareth Ryder Hanrahan. So worth that alone. Mothership and Triangle Agency both did very well. There's some new Mothership products that won. The Mothership electronic product won. And so Triangle Agency won, I believe, best game. They definitely won best writing. And I don't like to brag, but out of every game on sale at PAX Unplugged, I bought Triangle Agency with my own money because I knew it was going to be great. And it turns out it was. I had the same instinct with Mothership, and so it's nice to see that pay off as well. And speaking of my instincts, Shadow Dark, of course, was last year, but I got to sit at the Ennies with Kelsey Dion, the amazing creator of Shadow Dark, and because she was also presenting. And so I expect many great things out of Shadow Dark and Kelsey going forward as well, because that was just her first at bat and she nailed it, knocked it into the stands. The rest of the show, our buddies at Chaosium did their usual very good job of cleaning up any extra Ennies that people had lying around. Greg Stafford won an Ennie for Dragon Pass, best setting. Can't really argue with that, but one can make a little dog with his head on his side question mark about it, but that was nice to see.
Well, so, it would still be the majority of Greg's like text written by Greg would be still a big part of that book.
Right. Yeah. A big chunk of it, certainly. And then speaking of Chaosium, the best setting is Ireland. It turns out, Robin, the island of Ireland won best setting gold for Call of Cthulhu Ireland, which is in the community program at Chaosium. And, it was apparently an Irish designer who no one could hear because he recorded his thank you speech while standing on the ocean shore. So all we got to hear was the wind and the waves, which I guess apropos really in every way. But
well, I'm sure the wind and the waves contained a subliminal message that I'm glad you didn't hear correctly.
That only I was there for.
That could have been bad. And finally, you've been wrestling with a bit of an ethical conundrum.
I have been.
Because you've found a great place to eat. And of course, the conundrum there is, do we tell people about a new great place to eat within reach of the convention center, especially one that isn't slammed, because then it will be slammed. But I think we have a sufficiently, like we have a lot of listeners, but they're not all going to go at the exact same time to this place. And they did give you a free beer. So
right.
How does this conundrum resolve, Ken?
Well, it resolves with me saying that the Whistle Stop Inn, which is you go down towards Lucas Oil from the convention, and instead of going into the sea of food trucks, you go left, go up a block or two, and there's the Whistle Stop Inn. They, perfectly ordinary looking sort of neighborhood type sports bar, maybe a sports tavern is the better way to put it. And I walked in and the waitress said, we're out of tenderloins. And I said, oh, it's going to be that kind of day. But at that point, I just needed a shady seat and a beer. So I looked at the menu and they had on their menu, Robin, duck wings from a local duck farm that they sourced their duck from. They mentioned it by name. And I said, I will gamble a stamp on duck wings. And I had 6 duck wings, crispy duck wings, and I picked a maple bacon glaze for them. Superb choice, by the way. Came with the blue cheese, and so I dipped them in that. Even better choice. And the waffle fries, which the little waffles were even crispy, Robin, the little holes in the waffle. So the person at the grill, in addition to having a good recipe to work for, knew what they were doing. I met her later. She was terrific. And overall, that meal, even the non-comped beer or the non-generously gifted beer, the duck wings and the waffle fries, that may have been the third best meal I had at, no, I'm going to say it. It was the third best meal I had at Gen Con. And it is in probably my top 10 meals I've ever had in Indianapolis, probably my top 8 meals in Indianapolis. So I'm definitely going back. The bar is open, or the food is open until 2 a.m. on Saturday. So don't all rush in at 12:45, which is when I got there to find it 2/3 empty. And yeah, it was amazing. It was a great little bar, fine beer selection. They built cocktails if you wanted them. I did not want that at, as I say, 12:45. And if their regular wings are remotely as good as their duck wings, it's probably the best wings in Indianapolis too. So just throwing that out there. And then they, I assume, will stock in more tenderloins for later Gen Cons, because surely this will get back to them and they will say, we must be serving our Midwest specialty to a bunch of non-Midwesterners, or worse yet, Midwesterners from other states who look down their nose at Indiana. We can't have that happen.
Right. Well, it's not the first time we've thought, oh, they'll have institutional memory in Indianapolis yes. for Gen Con week and been surprised. But okay, well, go to the Whistle Stop Inn. Tell them Ken sent you.
Yes, and I will mention that, speaking of institutional memory, Steak and Shake has not run out of bacon, or at least had not run out of bacon by Friday. So someone at Steak and Shake was paying attention, in addition to having tallow fries, which I thought naively would be the best fries I had at Gen Con. Turned out they were only the second best fries I would have at Gen Con. So.
Right. Well, with so few Canadians going to the States, maybe it's that Canadians have been eating all the bacon all these years,
right.
And now there's
that's
more
why
for
there's
everyone else.
Excess bacon left over because the right. Sons of the Sacred Beaver had been neglecting their duties to balance the ecosystem.
Right. Well, I'm sure we've been eating equivalent amount of bacon here. Right. And on that note, time for us to wrap up this truncated Gen Con edition of the Traveler Advisory and move on through this exciting commercial to some other segment or hut. Now, 1968.
Sinister influences threaten to corrupt America from within and without.
The federal government establishes a new agency for overseas covert action.
The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD.
And within it, the forces of Delta Green.
In the Borealis Connection, the new globe-spanning mega-campaign for the fall of Delta Green, you become the mythos-hunting agents hidden inside the BNDD.
Play 8 linked operations.
As separate standalones.
Or linked into an epic hunt for an infamous target.
Escort a sniper carrying a death warrant for a Shan warlord.
Surveil a Saigon drug summit.
Track heroin couriers on a flight from Hong Kong to L.A.
Investigate the disappearance of an archaeologist working the Bozukepi ceremonial site.
Smash a Beirut drug deal.
ID the actors broadcasting the Necronomicon from a CIA backed Munich radio station.
And wage the drug war amid France's May 68 riots.
Designed by Kenneth Haidt.
Written by Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
The team that brought you the Zelazny Quartet and the Dracula Dossier.
The Borealis Connection.
Gorgeously designed and horrifically illustrated by Jen McCleary.
A tale of sordid intrigue.
Cosmic horror.
And desperate action against the mythos.
Now available in Titanic hardback.
From specially cleared gaming retail stores.
And the Pelgrane Press web store.
Now also at the web store as an instantly available PDF-only purchase. The whir of the projector, the smell of popcorn, and whatever that is under our feet as we make our way to the center seats in the center aisle welcome us once more into the cinema hut where we settle back down for our Fantasy Film Essentials series. And to begin our day at the festival, we settle back in our comfortable seats and I fall into a reverie, a little sleep. Perhaps I even dream. I dream of a screening that we unaccountably missed in 1959, a screening of Sleeping Beauty, directed by Claude Jaumini and animated by the Disney, Walt Disney Studios, with not as much Walt Disney supervising it, except to come back every time they brought him a script or a storyboard and say, that's too much like the other ones, go do it again. So the least useful kind of help is what Walt Disney provided for Sleeping Beauty. But the end result, I will maintain, because they were forced to sort of go outside their comfort zone a little bit, and the whole movie is based on these pastel tapestry-style backdrop paintings, the matte paintings, those become a character. The landscape of Sleeping Beauty becomes a character, even more, I would argue, than in Fantasia. And although many of the back paintings, Jaumini said, they're too noticeable, we need to blur them out a little bit with airbrushes so that the main action is visible. The end result is a Walt Disney animated feature. It's the last fully hand-drawn animated feature of the studio's career. Looks...
You mean of Disney?
Of yes.
Disney supervising.
No, this is the last fully drawn. They started using Xeroxes after this.
Oh, okay. So yeah. Robin Hood and the other ones do not count as fully drawn.
No, they don't. They all use Xeroxes for the cells. This is the last fully hand-drawn Disney animated feature, and as a result of Disney's unhelpful interference, but also as a result of the insistence by the background artists, Kay Nielsen and John Hench, who are the people who sort of said, let's do it tapestry style. And then Ivind Earle, who was the first background artist to be credited in a Disney film. And because he'd done so much of the actual art that showed up on screen, because of those three artists, you have a look for a Disney film that is not like other Disney films. And a lot of people, I think, respond negatively to that. They're like, I like my good old fashioned Snow White Fantasia look. But to me as a kid and to me as a grown up, Sleeping Beauty has a sort of a timelessness and a character of ethereality that the other Disneys do not. And also it has Maleficent, who is probably the best single villain in the history of Disney, and her big star turn when, spoiler alert, she transforms into a dragon is legitimately one of the scariest sequences ever put into a allegedly children's film. The big dragon fight is riveting and amazing and maybe one of the best dragon fights in fantasy cinema. It is certainly one of the best ones in animated fantasy cinema. And the way that Jeremini and the scriptwriters take the Charles Perrault story and tune it both towards children and identifying with the characters. Again, the Prince Philip is more of a person than your average Prince Charming in a Disney film, and also present this sort of epic level of combat and stakes and real horror. That's a tough tightrope to walk. And I think that only in Sleeping Beauty really does Disney do it. Although, as we alluded to previously, Pinocchio has its own sort of terrifying body horror going on every now and again.
I love the graphic design of the film. And when I was a kid, I had a little toy movie camera thing where you could run films back and forth in it. And the film that it came with was the dragon fight sequence at the end. So that's definitely imprinted on my consciousness. I find that the lead character is not as interesting as other Disney films. So I didn't accidentally leave it off the list, but I'm glad that you were able to put it back on the list, however, achronologically. But now let's get back to where we were in the order with the beginning of the 1970s and Valerie and Her Week of Wonders. This is from 1970 by Jaromil Jiříš. It's a Czech film, and it's based on a 1935 surreal fantasy novel by Vítězslav Nezval, and it is about a 13-year-old girl who has her first period. Her world is fairy tale idol, and then all of a sudden, the attention of the world is on her now that she is passing into womanhood, and a nightmarish fairy tale realm descends on her of just regular male attention of witches and Nosferatu-style vampires and evil priests and just regular dudes who want to burn her at the stake. It's a really compelling, dark fairy tale with a real message about the way that women are treated in it. And it's a lesser-known essential, but I would argue a big essential. Now we'll move to an extremely well-known essential, Ken. Tell us why both of us love Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory by Mel Stewart from 1971.
Yeah, this is written by Roald Dahl, the script from his novel, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and the Great Chocolate Factory. And this is first of all, it's a triumph of casting. Gene Wilder is Willy Wonka. Everyone who has played Willy Wonka since has done a better or worse Gene Wilder impression. None of them have tried to go and do a second take on the character. Even more than Dracula, Willy Wonka has been permanently imprinted as Gene Wilder, and Wilder's combination of sort of fey delight and, what do I want to say, sociopathy nailed the character. The other actors are mostly forgettable in the sense of we don't remember who they are per se. They didn't move on to great other careers. Roy Kinnear does play Henry Salt, but Peter Ostrom as Charlie Bucket is a great child actor at the time, and he goes to the titular chocolate factory with other children who are all horrible children. One of the child actors was also a horrible child, and he was stung by a bee during production. So there you go. Magic happens. And the children all give in to temptation at this, what do I want to say, demonic chocolate factory, because of course that's what it is. They are carried away, not quite murdered by it, but, you know, it's pretty bad.
You are allowed to think they've been murdered.
You're certainly allowed to
think they've been murdered. Basically the entire runtime, yes. And then there's a square up reel at the end.
Right. A sort of ha, 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 we didn't really make you watch child murder. Nudge elbow in rib.
Right. And you enjoyed all those child murders, yes, because the children being murdered deserved it.
They deserved it completely.
In poetically deserving ways.
Plus with a cool song. And the songs are great. They're wonderful. It's a wonderful musical. Back in the day when Hollywood could make wonderful musicals at the drop of a hat. And I mean, the story is terrific because it's Roald Dahl. The acting is all, you know, very good. No one ruins it with that. But I think that the thing that we all take away from it forever is Gene Wilder sort of cocking his head to one side and emitting an atrocity. And that is the heart, I think, of a lot of fantasy, and certainly the heart of Roald Dahl's fantasies. And it was inexplicably shown for family viewing endlessly. And I think everyone who grew up in the 70s and 80s saw it a lot on television. And the reason we kept watching it is it's just that good.
Right. You're just back from Gen Con, so I'll complete a thought that was a little ambiguous, which is that Gene Wilder is as much Willy Wonka as Bela Lugosi is Dracula.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, Gene Wilder did not make a string of Dracula movies.
No.
Unless I've stepped into a horrible dimension.
But there has never been a Christopher Lee to challenge him for the title. is the other That's half right. of that. That Johnny Depp and Timothy Chalamet, as delightful as they may be severally, do not a Christopher Lee make, even standing on each other's shoulders.
Right. And so, yes, absolutely, this is a fantasy essential and is suffused with the thing that makes Roald Dahl stories for children what they are, which is his mean streak.
Yeah.
Which usually is scrubbed out of stuff for kids, but the Dahl stuff somehow gets a pass and mostly gets through. We're going to move on now to Arabian Nights. We've talked about a lot of Arabian Nights movies in this series. This also, again, if you eliminate things because of Orientalism, you'll want to do that here because 1970s Italian Marxists are not necessarily have the same sensibility that you want today. But Pier Paolo Pasolini's film of Arabian Nights is magical and strange and beautiful. This is a case of a major world cinema auteur sort of borrowing some of the aspects of the early 70s softcore craze. He is also completing a trilogy with the Canterbury Tales and the Decameron, both of which are sort of anthology films of classic works of early literature. Those two are both distinguished by their nasty, grotty look, the kind of thing that makes medievalists mad by showing the Middle Ages as dirty and filthy. Well, Arabian Nights turns that on its head. Everything in this film is beautiful. The people are beautiful. Pasolini was a gay man, but there's something in here for everybody. And it focuses on the sort of human-scaled stories from the Arabian Nights. It drops out the framing device. In fact, sort of replaces it with something more Canterbury-esque. And a lot of the stories that it covers are just the same sort of picaresque human stories that he looked at in the other two films. But there's still stories with a djinn, a demon, there's prophecies. It is beautiful, and its spirit is magical. And it is not a film that you want to watch with your mom, not a film you want to watch with your kids, but definitely a world cinema essential and a fantasy essential.
And speaking of titans of world cinema doing fantasy, this is not our first foray into fantasy from Ingmar Bergman, but it is the first collab between Ingmar Bergman and Mozart, 1975's The Magic Flute. And Robin, as our Bergmanologist, take it away from there.
Right. So you mentioned Tales of Hoffman possibly being the best opera film of all time, and maybe it is, but if it isn't, The Magic Flute is. So this is a film that Bergman was obsessed with, The Magic Flute, which of course is a story of magic and dragons and a magical queen of the night who you don't want to mess with, getting in the way of true love. And it says it right in the title, there's a magic flute as the main plot device. So it's definitely a fantasy film. And so the conceit, though, is very interesting because it's as if you were seeing a period production done at the time of its original inception in the 1790s, being staged in the Drottningholm Palace Theater, which is one of the rare Baroque opera houses still standing in the world. It's in Stockholm. It uses exterior shots of the actual place. The actual interiors were reproduced on a soundstage because that building, a precious heritage building, which is fragile, was not going to put up with the rigors of a film production. But what you see in the film is it is as if you are watching a production being staged. So you see people backstage pulling the curtains and the scenic pieces. You see them, the artifice of the production. And then the artifice of that through the performance starts to drop away and it becomes more filmic and becomes more real, but always fantastical. And therein, through that device and the visual nature of it, is the theme of the film coming through, which again is another fantasy film about the importance of fantasy and the imagination. And in this case, of the power of the stage and therefore also of the power of film. And of course, as goes without saying, the power of Mozart. And during the Laserdisc era, this was one of the discs that you got, even if you didn't like Mozart or Bergman, to show how great your setup was. And it was originally done for TV, but it's a beautiful, lavish production nonetheless, and well worth checking out if you want a little bit of beauty in your life for a while and to see someone say, I'm going to do a magic trick. Watch as I do a magic trick. And you say, I can see you doing this magic. Oh, I've been magicked, perhaps by a flute. And on that note, we've looked at the early 70s, And so we'll put down our Fantasy Film Fest, let you go off and check out some of these things perhaps, and be back with more next week. And now it's time for another segment. In the Spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Protect this podcast from the Queen of the Night by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Ludovic Chavant,
Luke Silburn,
Andy M. Young,
Martin Rundquist,
and Mark Kevin Hall.
Welcome back to Ken and or Robin Talk to Someone Else. And as you can tell from the strange echoes and the occasional thuds in the wall, I am talking to someone else at Gen Con in the beautiful Embassy Suites in downtown Indianapolis. But today, we're making up for all that troublesome ruckus and noise by talking to old friend, friend of the program, friend of the podcast, friend of me personally, Stacey Muth, the impresario behind the Annie Awards, who I think it's fair to say, under your tenure, we have taken the Ennies from that thing that happens to the centerpiece social event of the show.
Oh, and you're very kind.
You think that seems fair? Maybe it's not fair to Russ, but he's not here. He's not doing the interview, is he?
He's not.
Take that, Russ. So tell us about, you know, what made you, a seemingly normal, intelligent woman, say, what I really need to do is run the Ennie Awards. What in a month of Sundays, a year, I would never think I want to run an award show. And yet, here you are running one. What's that about?
Here I am. They just kind of fell into my lap. So I have been a gamer for a long time. Got the red box as a Christmas gift. God bless my parents who didn't understand. But it was a game about math and dragons. And they just knew that little Stacy would just absolutely adore it. And I did. And so that was my introduction. And I've kind of been a gamer ever since. I happened to stumble across message boards way back when they were a thing, and EN World, that was the original, that's where ENI comes from, is the EN World Awards,
right.
And I was a member on that, and they'd start talking about this
when
awards.
I write my ENIs on my fancy resumes and job applications, I have to say the EN World Award.
Exactly, at that time, not anymore.
Yeah.
But yes, and they were asking for judges. And at the time, I had some friends that had been judges, and I thought, you know what, I think I would enjoy doing this. And so I applied to be a judge, and I was a sitting judge for several years in a row, luckily, you know, to be voted in. So the masses didn't think I did too bad of a job. And in my fourth-ish year as a judge, I happen to know who was running the awards at the time. That was the Whiteheads. And they said, you know, would you quit running for judge because we really think you could run this.
Right.
I have a pretty strong organizational background. I have a law degree, but I do not practice law, but I work for a legal company. And so I have lots of organizational background. And I said, well, I'll think about it, and went back and talked to my husband. And, you know, because this is, while I'm kind of the face, it's a family affair. It has to be.
It's a team.
It's a team event, and luckily I have a lot of very understanding friends who also appreciate the Ennie Awards as well, so I have them helping me. So it's certainly not just a couple people, and we're all volunteers. I don't get paid to do this. It's a volunteer for truly the love of the hobby. So that's how I ended up with it. And then I was the business manager for Russ Morrissey, because at the time, the Ennie Awards were run by EN World. And they started 25 years ago as, hey, kids, we should really have some kind of award for this neat thing called the D20 system. And that's how it started, as an online award, and move forward. And I know you're very well aware. You would make noise from a mile away with all the Ennie Awards if you had them hanging around your neck.
There are jurisdictions that I'm required to, in fact. The EN World Awards began, they were on my radar because at that time, I had a little web column called Out of the Box, and I gave my own awards, the Audi Awards, and so everyone thought the Audis and the Ennies was hilarious. It's less hilarious now, but it was hilarious then. And so I thought, well, I don't write a lot of D20. I'm glad that that award exists. And then at some point they said, oh, we're actually the only properly run award in the whole art form. Maybe we should do more than just D20. Right. Also, the D20 bubble had kind of begun deflating. And they made that jump. And I guess the only real kick against the Ennies is not even you guys' fault. It's nothing you're controlling. It's that not every company that produces great games submits to the Ennie Awards. Right. They're not eligible because of they don't submit.
Right.
Is there any sort of outreach program? Are you guys thinking, well, we're the Oscars, send the damn movie? Or are you trying to work with, like, you know, White Wolf or whoever and say, maybe submit, because you'd probably win some of the stuff.
Well, we don't promise anybody winning, but do promise
chances
everybody
go up if they're submitted.
Exactly. Statistically, they got a lot better chance
yes,
to submit.
Exactly.
Because the publishers have to submit. But we also encourage, if you're a creator and your company doesn't submit, as long as they give you permission, you can submit yourself. It doesn't have to be the publisher.
Right.
We just need to know that they're okay with it, right? That they're, because we,
but it's harder for an individual writer to pony up 17 copies or whatever it is.
It's six, and you can submit digitally. I think about half the submissions we had this year were digital, and that's just fine. So that makes it a little bit easier, more accessible to individuals. But we do have a bit of an outreach program. We, you know, anytime we see anybody talking about, hey, I've got this new game, the judges help us with that. If they notice things out there, they'll let our submissions coordinator know, Mark Causey, and he will reach out and say, hey, I'm the submissions coordinator for the Ennie Awards. Here's what we are. Here's what we do. Please consider submitting to this. We'd love to have you participate.
Right.
So we do have a little bit. It's hard to get the word out there. I mean, we've been going for 25 years, but there are still still people like, what are the Ennie Awards?
And there's new companies every year. Exactly. They don't know necessarily.
Exactly. So something else we do here at the show, we do have a booth in the exhibitor hall where we display all the nominees for the year, and we really promote there as well. And we try to get around, those of us on the staff go around and try to talk to any new companies we see, introduce ourselves, let them know what we're about, so that they can bring stuff to our booth and we'll take them in right there at Gen Con. That saves them the shipping.
So the Ennie Awards are voted on by the internet at large.
Yes.
All you have to be is the kind of problem person who goes to gaming websites. And what's the numbers like on that, and how has that gone up, I assume, increased under your tenure? And do you think you've plateaued? Are you still heading into new crazy heights?
You know, I thought we
with
would
role
plateau.
Playing booming insanely.
It is amazing to me that, and exciting, that this hobby continues to expand at the level it's expanding to. Since I've taken over, and I have officially owned the Ennie since around 2017, 2018, when Russ Morrissey and EN World decided they wanted to get into publishing and they didn't want any conflict of interest.
Right.
with owning an award show for the industry.
Exactly.
So he turned it over to me. They have nothing to do with it other than we continue to call it the Ennie Awards.
Yes.
Because we won't change that tradition. So when I took over, we had, when I was a judge, we were excited to get 300, 350 submissions. And slowly over time, it would continue. This year, we've had over 1,000. Last year, it was a little over 900. It has grown exponentially year over year for at least the last 10 years.
And the number of votes, likewise? Votes,
same way. This year, we had over 37,000 individual IPs because we track by IP. That's one IP, one vote. Yeah, I could talk about why we do the voting the way we do. But and that is statistically, I think we had 32,000 last year. So it does. We continue to expand. Voices are getting out there, and we continue to see growth. So it's exciting.
Yeah, and that's sort of the other half of the coin. The other half of the coin, good Lord, Ken, are you a writer? is that you can't just expand to publishers. You also need to expand to voters. The Ennies, I know that everyone who wins one is super happy. They like to post about it on their socials, et cetera, et cetera. Are there other things besides the live stream of the show? Are you thinking about, I mean, I know that today the kids love everything in their 90-second TikToks. Is there a active social media outreach that you're running or that you're having some young, energetic, chromatic-haired child run?
I will take you as a volunteer.
Yes, that's right. Put the 59-year-old man in charge of your TikTok. Never been a better idea than that.
I know, and I, you know, being 50-something myself, I am not the young crowd either, and that is an area I will surely admit we can do better. We can do absolutely better with our socials. We always tweet through Twitter, a long time Twitter, so we could get the nominees out and the sponsors and the night of the awards show. We will tweet the winners. We're also now on Blue Sky. We finally come into this out of the Stone Age, and we have an official Blue Sky account. So we'll be sending, I don't know what they call posts on Blue Sky, but we will be.
I'm not sure they know yet.
I don't think they know yet either. But it's okay. We're going to be posting winners out there as well. And I have someone who is very excited about helping with social media as well. So hopefully we'll be able to do more with that. That's one of the goals in our coming year, is to expand our visibility out there, except, you know, when we're posting, hey, make sure you're submitting and reminding everybody to submit. And then this time of year when we're promoting all the nominees and voting.
Because a lot of people now, an increasing amount of people, maybe even half the hobby, are consuming games in a different way than they ever have. They're doing it through streaming. They're doing it through actual plays. They're doing it through other sorts of things that to old grognards like myself seem weird and dangerous. Is there, like this year, that it's just streaming content? It's not just podcasts, but it's podcasts and APs and all kinds of things. Is there a danger or a promise that suddenly you're the Oscars, but for critical role?
What's that struggle
like?
Well, it is a challenging thing. Because our judges are people too, right? There are five of them, and they have other jobs. They volunteer. They, God bless them. Yeah. They volunteer too.
Yeah, 1,000 products is too many for five judges.
Exactly. The new sort of judges will get their first box from me in mid to end August, and it starts immediately, where they'll start reviewing, and then they go up until March 31st is our deadline. We did push it back because we recognized that 6 weeks before they needed to get it all together was just not enough time. So we've given them an extra month so that they have time to do that. But you're absolutely right. I would love to do better service to all the streaming type content, the podcasts, the actual plays, the YouTube channels. And I'm sure there's something new out there that I don't even know about yet, because there's always something new. But I fear that if I add more categories, we go to a 5-hour show.
Right, yeah.
And that's judges, always a problem. And that's always a problem. And also, how do judges judge hour-long, 3-hour-long, segments of shows? And is one enough? Right now, it's a requirement for 15 minutes, and then from there, the judges can go out and listen to more and to make better decisions. But when we limited that down because we were having 3 to 6 hour submissions that the judges were on the list to, and it just
it can't be done.
So we went to a, well, let's do streaming content, and I know it's not, it doesn't do service to that area of the hobby. I know it doesn't. So the discussion that we'll be on having this year is, do we even have that? Do I divest myself? And because I know there are other awards out there that do it. But at the same time, the minute I hint that, and if when this gets out there, I'm going to get emails from people saying, I know it's not enough, but please just keep what you got.
Right. Well, I mean, people do consider the Annie Awards to be the sort of gold standard.
Yeah.
And even if you're turning the streaming over to the streamies or whatever they are, that almost seems in a way like, you know, oh, I'm sorry, we're not accepting movies from Scandinavia this year.
Right.
And it's an odd set of challenges to have to be in charge of this award in a time when what counts as the industry is so shifty and nebulous and changing all
exactly.
the time. Every time I've asked you a question, you have come back and you said, I know this is a problem, we're going to fix it. That is not the point of this interview.
No, that's okay.
Stacey.
I'd rather talk about the issues, because I can talk about all the fun stuff, right, and the stuff we're doing right. But for you and for your fans listening and you know, the friends in the hobby, I want them to know that, hey, we're not blind to it. We always can do better, and I appreciate that. I always want to do better.
Well, what I want you to do is a little something that I call Monster of Arrogance time. I want you to say, you know, what is the best thing, the best reward that the Ennies have brought, maybe not to you, but the thing you're the happiest to have been involved in with regard to the Ennies, not counting me and Robin hosting, because obviously that's the pinnacle. Never come back to that.
It truly was. Absolutely.
But what do you look back and you say, yep, whatever else has happened, I hit that dinger into the seats. I'm queen of the Ennies. All y'all can back off.
I appreciate that. So there are a couple things. One, that's something I'm really proud about, is that we have put in a Hall of Fame. Something we've always talked about, because we only go back 25 years.
Right.
And the industry is certainly much, much older than that, double that, right? Mm-hmm. And wanted to go back and recognize the roots, the history of where gaming started. They didn't have an opportunity to have an award. They were just doing it for the love of the game as well. Mm-hmm. So we started in last year. And almost every month for the past year, we have just inducted someone in. We started with D&D and then moved on to Call of Cthulhu and B1, B2 Adventures and Dragon Magazine and Real Potter. I'm really proud of that, because I think that also solidifies foundations of what's coming. Mm-hmm. And we're gonna have a live induction at an award show night on Friday night. I'm going to keep that part of the surprise.
Fantastic.
That we have someone coming that's going to accept an award. And the behind the Hall of Fame is, it has to be 25 years or older.
Right.
In order, because we're going to eventually at some point we'll probably start doing a regular Hall of Fame. But right now we're just playing catch up.
Yeah.
So I'm really proud of that. I'm also really proud, for me, what gives me energy with this award show, because it is quite a bit of work, and I acknowledge that. And everybody also asks me, why do you keep doing this? The excitement on people's faces and the emails that I get when they get nominated. Because that's the point of this. The point of this is to do a little thank you to the people that are doing this. Nobody's getting rich. Well, not most people aren't getting rich. A few people get really lucky. But most people aren't. And that you're still grinding away in their basement after work, whatever. And they've come up with this beautiful product they have created. And if we can recognize even a mere drop in the bucket of all the stuff being made out there, that gives me energy. And we have people come back. We had someone come back and contact a judge that had picked their product as a judge's pick a few years ago, and just recently got an email saying, hey, I just want to reach out and thank you and let you know. This changed my life. It put it on my resume, and I got selected to be part of a gaming company because I had that on my resume, and I'm now a full-time game creator, and I don't pull in the parking lot of my job and feel miserable. I actually have been able to move forward and pursue and make a career in this hobby. And it started with an Ennies award.
Well, if you guys are wondering what is the Stacey with experience, I literally just asked Kurt to brag. And she said, I'm happiest with recognizing other talents and encouraging new talent. So, I don't know, people. I've only got 15 minutes. I can't make Stacey Muth brag about herself.
Sorry.
Maybe next time. thank you so much for coming. It's always great to see you. It's great to see you at the Annies. It's great to know that you're in charge of the Annies. There's one part of this monkey circus that is not going to fly into the side of a building anytime soon. It's just a delight to have you in the role that you're in as sort of the, not necessarily the steward of our excellence, but at least the celebrator of our excellence, the big gong banger of our excellence. And I'm very, very happy that you're doing it. And I'm even happier that you're here on the podcast to talk a little bit and hopefully give people an idea of why it's so great that you're in charge.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Ken. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much. With that outpouring of love, it is time for you to pour out your love to whatever lucky sponsor is on the other end of this segment.
The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
The clacking of time gears and the whirring of chronotons tell us that we're once more in proximity to Ken's time machine. This, of course, is a conveyance that Ken's superiors at Time Incorporated used to send him back into history to sometimes bend, fold, staple, and sometimes, yes, even mutilate it. And this time around, Ken, you have a very specific mission with parameters. So you've been given time credentials to pass yourself off as an American delegate in the wake of World War I, attending the Paris Conference, where the Allies have all gathered. The Germans are not yet present. They're later going to be presented with a phone book-sized proposal for the surrender that they're supposed to sign. But before they get to that, the Allies start carving up the maps of Europe and beyond. Now, normally, you get free rein, you can do whatever you want, but here, due to chronoton fluctuations, you're permitted to do two things. One, of course, side-eye Woodrow Wilson, who is present for a large part of this. And secondly, you can change the configuration of only a single one of the many borders that will wind up being redrawn as part of this process. So what border do you choose, and how does your change affect the timeline?
Okay. First of all, I have to register my suspicion when Time Incorporated says, oh, mysterious chronoton issues prevent you from just booping a little bit backward and taking out Woodrow Wilson. I'm always suspicious when I'm sent in proximity to Wilson and told, oh, sorry, technically no can do with the solving. But yes,
it's a legitimate chronoton issue due to all of the other times you've tried to kill Woodrow Wilson.
Kill, sideline, immure.
Sideline, whatever.
Whatever.
Yes. You've canceled yourself out. And some of those were the evil Kens. So it's a tangle.
Once I do it an odd number of times, it's back into business, baby. Anyway.
Right.
He does get a massive side eye, but mostly it's me and a young historian, William L. Langer, running around and getting drunk in Paris. That's good fun. But when I come back to do my actual border drawing job, as you suggest, there is a plenitude of possibilities. And the trouble is, I can redraw a border in the treaty, but if the facts on the ground don't support it, I'm still SOL. So, for example, one of the things that Woodrow Wilson did want was for an American mandate over Armenia. And he proposed that there be an independent Armenia that would basically be the northeastern chunk of Turkey from Trabzon east, and then the now independent, then soon to be Soviet Armenia would be added to it. There'd be a big Armenia, the Americans would guarantee its independence, and everything would have been better, at least for the Armenians. The trouble is that the Senate rejected that policy because it was tied in with the League of Nations. And if they're not going to ratify the League, they're not going to ratify an Armenian mandate. So Armenia is once more tossed to the wolves, regardless of what I can do. Likewise.
Right, because mandate would have meant American governance and right. American troops on the ground.
Exactly.
That was the issue.
And us working at the behest of the League of Nations, which we weren't going to recognize. And that's, you know, even if the U.S. Senate had wanted to send American troops to Armenia, which, spoiler, they did not, they definitely would not have wanted to do so under the auspices of some bandied about League of Nations, as if that was a thing. So anyway, the next candidate for great historical wrong to be undone at the peace would be Ukraine, which its independence was recognized in the treaty, and then the Red Army rolled over it anyway and killed everybody. And that was the end of, you know, Ukraine. And again, nothing I can do. I can't draw that border extra hard. I can't draw it Red Army proof, and I'm not allowed to go, you know, blow up Trotsky or something. Although.
Right. So these are both like good or well-meaning borders that
right.
you would have done more to help were that possible.
Right.
Which,
yeah.
You're saying it's not.
Right. And then if I am restricted to the one single border rule, I don't want to get into the weeds of these little enclaves. Most of them had plebiscites and they went to the majority of the people in the area, you know, Teschen down in Silesia, little bits and bobs between Czechoslovakia and Poland, things like that. That I'm happy to leave to the plebiscitary process as bad as it is. But the Saarland, where they carve the Saarland out of Germany, and they say, this will be under League of Nations supervision for 15 years, and all of its money will go to France. That's just needlessly stupid and offensive. Just add to the German reparations total if you want, but cutting the Saarland out, even more than demilitarizing the Rhineland, is just a needless stick in the eye to the Germans. Now, I am not right. necessarily...
So tell people where the Saarland is or was and what its significance is.
Right. The Saarland is the main coal mining region at that time of the western half of Germany. It is just north of... you got your Alsace-Lorraine on the Rhine Valley. The Saar is just a little bit north of the Rhineland itself, and it is in a little pocket. It's near Belgium. And it's right around like Dusseldorf, places like that. So the notion was that the French would get a special lien on all the coal money coming out of the Saar on the grounds that all their coal mines got ruined in the war. And while that's accurate, it's needlessly offensive to Germany, a Germany that you want to become a member of the global community.
Right. And the whole tension of these conferences is between particularly France, the question of do they want to regain what they lost in the war? And do they want to disable Germany so that it can never attack them again? Or do they want a Germany that is going to make peace with them and have this constant threat of warfare between the two countries go away? And
yeah.
in the wake of all of the damage that France sustained, it was extremely popular to put the screws to Germany to the maximum extent possible.
Yeah. And I'm not one of those maximalist Keynes-style historians that says that the Treaty of Versailles caused Hitler. The hyperinflation was caused basically as an attempt to pay off the Treaty of Versailles. But the humiliations of Versailles were not the big thing that caused Hitler. It was the humiliations of losing World War I that caused Hitler. If you don't want Hitler, let the Kaiser win. I didn't think you wanted it that bad. So the Saar, though, is the one boundary that is... It adds insult to injury, and if the insult turned out to make a difference, it'd be best not to have it. But in terms of making the world a better place going forward, the biggest thing that the treaties out of Paris did was they signed off on making the king of Serbia the king of the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, the king of what after 1922 was called Yugoslavia. And Yugoslavia, the notion that Austria-Hungary was too oppressive to its local groups, so we're going to bust it up and let everyone have their own nationhood, but not the South Slavs. They need to be put under a unifying monarchy, just like Austria-Hungary, and it'll surely be just as big a success. That's just dumb on the face of it. And so if I'm allowed to not change a border, but change a designation, and then maybe draw a couple extra borders... I want no Yugoslavia. I want Serbia can go ahead and share Vojvodina with the Hungarians. I assume that what happens with Bosnia-Herzegovina is that the Serbs get Bosnia and the Croats get Herzegovina. That basically is how it played out in our history, but only after several hundred thousand lives were lost. And so I would, by and large, like to prevent the Croatian fascist party, the Ustasha, from ever rising. The people in charge of Croatia in 1918 were called the Croatian Peasant Party. And their most radical opinion was they did not want to be run by the King of Serbia, which you can hardly argue with that much. So the notion that we are going to basically recreate Austro-Hungary with all the inherent problems is one that I would ideally get rid of. And then when World War II comes about, maybe the Nazis still invade pro-Russian Serbia, but maybe they leave the rest of Yugoslavia alone, or maybe they invade Slovenia and then get jammed up in the mountains of Croatia. They still have a whole nother country to fight through. At the very least, it makes the Nazis' problems harder, which I like. And if, as the Treaty of London hinted, which is what set up this whole notion in the first place, the Italians get a chunk of Dalmatia, maybe you've taken some of the wind out of the fascist party of Italy's sails, because they can turn around and say, look, we were a good ally and a good democracy, and we got everything we were promised at the Treaty of London. No problems here. We have no interest in your fascist nonsense, Mussolini, you communist. And so that would just move along nicely. I don't guarantee that that will happen, but I will guarantee that if you get Yugoslavia, you get a horrendous local fascist movement. You get a sectarian war up between the partisans. You get a communist dictatorship over the whole shebang, and you get a civil war anyway that results in all those countries becoming independent countries, but only after several hundred thousand lives have been lost and several more egregious examples of ethnic cleansing and genocidal slaughter have occurred. And I would like to maybe obviate that by skipping to the good part.
So I guess the gaming potential of this whole story is being at the conference and all this sort of scheming. I think it would make a killer LARP if people don't mind a little bit more history exposition in their LARP packs than they would normally be accustomed to, because there were people from all over who had interests from all over. We haven't even gotten into what was then referred to as Mesopotamia and the different territorial shenanigans going on there. Even the Japanese and Chinese were involved in this a little bit. And so
Ho Chi Minh was there. He was not even Ho Chi Minh yet. He was taking spare time from his career as, I believe, a chef or a waiter. I forget. He was working in food service. And then at night, he would come over to the peace conference and advocate for the independence of Indochina with no effect, apparently.
Right. So this is just begging to be a LARP, Nordic or otherwise, and something that there's all sorts of spy activity in the background, because everybody was trying to get everybody else's dossiers and find out what their real hardline positions were and what could be negotiated away. So you could also have a sort of an intrigue spy action thing going on in the background of that. And the leaders conference is just sort of the backdrop for the shenanigans with the different security services. And at this point, Germans were not even allowed to operate freely in Paris. But they were there as covert operatives. So that's another element that you could throw into the mix.
And if you're doing my no Yugoslavia plan, then your 1920s become different and more exciting, because you've got all manner of fun, new, different countries to do things in. The number of terrorists interested in murdering the King of Serbia, I think, drops down. It was Macedonian terrorists that did it. So maybe it's the same effect, but at least the fascist clampdown that Yugoslavia did only affects Serbia and doesn't affect the rest of the thing. But you can go ahead and be playing, you know, do a switch up. In the 1930s, you're doing heroic democratic Croatian operatives against fascist Serbs. So if you've got your old Balkan alignments from the 40s, they're swapped around in this version. So that could be fun.
Well, on that note, it's time for us to congratulate ourselves, and especially you, Ken, for so diligently completing a immediate post-Gen Con episode. We'll be back next week when Gen Con will be further in the distance. But you were perfectly articulate. You didn't even sound like your voice was wrecked this time. So I think you and therefore by reflection, I am entitled to even more congratulations than usual. But we'll be back next week with more of this. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flag Bearer Games.
Dark Tower.
and Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep this podcast on the map with access to the sea by joining such backers as
Sikander,
Alexander Araballo,
Derek Heimforth,
Robert Wolf,
and Dave Barr.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Grab our latest design, Subtlety is for People Who Forgot Their Battering Ram.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.